Trump should recreate a version of the Phoenix program, the CIA assassination ring that operated during the Vietnam War to fight ISIS.
It was a vicious but very effective kill capture program in Vietnam that destroyed the Viet Cong as a military force. That's what needs to be done to the funders of Islamic terror, and that would be even the wealthy radical Islamist billionaires funding it from the Middle East and any of the other illicit activities they're in.
That was Eric Prince, the significance of what he's saying here, Jeremy.
Well, you know, remember, Eric Prince views himself as the rightful heir to the legacy of Wild Bill Donovan, who was the head of the agency that was the precursor to the CIA. And, you know, immediately after 9/11, Eric Prince became very, very close to a number of people within the CIA and also Dick Cheney and Dick Cheney's office. And they jointly came up with this idea that Eric Prince could run a kind of off-the-books hit squad that could roam the world conducting assassinations for the United States. And there would be, you know, no effective paper trail and no ability for Congress to engage in any oversight. Now, Leon Panetta, who was Obama's CIA director early on in Obama's term, said, oh, we shut down that program and no one was ever killed. I don't believe that for one moment. That was part of the legacy of the Phoenix program that was a murderous death squad operation in Vietnam that also included enhanced interrogation. What Eric Prince being around Trump indicates to me is that—
And talk about what you found out about election night and what his role is. We just have 50 seconds.
Right. Well, Robert Mercer, the billionaire hedge funder. His daughter Rebecca ran one of the most important super PACs to Trump, Make America Number One super PAC. And Trump and Eric Prince and his mother Elsa were two of the largest contributors to one of the most significant super PACs that supported Donald Trump. Eric Prince is very close to Robert Mercer. Prince was also at the Heroes and Villains party that Mercer threw in Long Island after the election. And in fact, there's a picture that Peter Thiel, the right-wing billionaire who destroyed Gawker, a picture of Peter Thiel, Donald Trump, and Eric Prince that Peter Thiel says is not safe for the internet. It's clear that Eric Prince, through Betsy DeVos, through Robert Mercer, and through his very right-wing paramilitary crowd, has the ear of President-elect Donald Trump. And our understanding from a very well-placed source is that Prince has even been advising Trump on his selections for the staffing of the Defense Department and the State Department.
We're going to have a post-show discussion and post online at democracynow.org. That's Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of The Intercept. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Hollow Sidewalk's Year of the Field Mouse record release show, Wednesday, January 18th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Hollow Scene in Portland. Year of the Field Mouse is the second album by Hollow Sidewalks. Also playing the show is Slutty Hearts and Shadow House. Again, that's the Hollow Sidewalks record release show, Wednesday, January 18th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Hollow Scene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the Hope page under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets every third Thursday at 5 o'clock p.m.
Ready for the war, we got our boots strapped. 100 deep on State Street where the troops at. The mayor lying, say didn't see the video footage, and everybody wanna know where the truth at. On the south side where it's no trauma centers but the most trauma. A lot of cannons but you don't want no drama. I can't imagine if it was my own mama. Got a firstborn son, stole from her. He never had a chance, and we all know it's cause he black. Shot him 16 times, how fucked up is that? Now the police superintendent wanna double back. Cops beating up to the block like a running back. Tension is high, man, these niggas is irate. irate. You can see it in their eyes, they wanna violate. Screaming out, oink, oink, bang, bang, gang, 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 gang. Murder, 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 they mind state. I just made me a meal and still militant. This ain't conscious rap, this shit ignorant. The hair trigger ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun.
When I cock back, police better run.
16 shots, and we bucking back. 16 shots, and we bucking back. 16 shots. They threw a little girl down on the pavement, pushed her with a bike and said, stay out the way. She was bleeding on the ground through her braces. This what happened when niggas don't stay in their places. The mayor dumping weight, he fired the superintendent. But resignation come with bonuses and recognition. So we gonna break in the story.
All right, good morning. This is KBOO Portland. This is Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowan. And that was Vic Mensa, 16 Shots, a Chicago rapper. I'm sure my guest will know way more about it than I do. That was suggested by Derek Crooks, our morning public affairs director. And yes, my guest is Rosa Clemente, who will be in town at Clark College in Vancouver this evening to give a keynote address as the college is honoring the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King. And the event is free and open to the public. It will be at Geyser Student Center on Clark's main campus from noon to 1:30. That's actually not tonight. That's this afternoon. And that's the talk is Transformation, a New Era of Social Activism. That's the title I gave to the show, but there's so much to talk about. And after I do a few brief announcements, if Rosa can hang on for just a second, there's so much happening. So this evening, intersections of activism from 6 to 8 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student Community Center at 710 Southwest Jackson Street. Feeling frustrated over the elections, want to make a change? This panel will explore the intersections of art, protest, and law in making positive change and how you can get involved. The event is free and open to the community. Dinner is provided. And if you have any accommodation needs, please reach out. That's this evening. And of course, there's many things coming up regarding the inauguration. Not My President PSU Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. in the South Park blocks. Hundreds of students will be walking out of their classes to join in protesting the policies of hate of the incoming president. And they will join with community members and faculty members in the South Park blocks at PSU this Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. And they will march to join with the protest that will be going on at Pioneer Square starting at 3:30 p.m. Then Friday evening, join the resistance at Inauguration Night of Music and Organizing to Fight the Trump Agenda. That's at 6 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom. That's there on Southeast Morrison, I believe. I'm sure you can find out. They've got a Facebook page and all that. Join the resistance. That's DJ Anjali, Love Bomb, Agogo, Portland Samba, many grassroots organizations. And then the next day, Saturday, a labor community and community united front against the Trump agenda, rally and march. That's 10 to 11:30 at Shemansky Park there in Southwest Portland. And people will be able to join the women's march, which begins at noon, I believe, at Waterfront Park. So that's some of the things that are going on. I'm sure there's more. You can possibly call in and let us know about them, 503-231-8187. So let me tell you about our guest. I had her on just four years ago, about exactly the same time. We were talking with Jared Ball from Baltimore and Mike Crenshaw about the false heirs of Martin Luther King. That was, of course, around the time of the second Obama inauguration and the also the unveiling of the Martin Luther King monument in downtown Washington, D.C. Anyway, Rosa is co-founder of the National Hip Hop Political Convention and a leading scholar on Afro-Latino-Latina identity. From Harvard to prisons, she spent her life dedicated to scholar activism, longtime community organizer. She's currently a doctoral student in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department at UMass Amherst. And she's sat on various boards, including Black Lives Matter, the National Priorities Project, and others. And she also served with Cynthia McKinney as the Green Party's candidate for vice president in the 2008 U.S. election. So with all that, good morning, Rosa Clemente.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. So where are you right now?
I am in Vancouver, Washington, about to speak at Clark.
That's right, because I was thinking it was this evening until I actually read the program. So obviously you're there since it's starting in just a few hours, and we'll announce that a couple times. So like I said, there's so much to talk about these days. But maybe we could just start by you telling us a little bit about what you are going to be talking about at Clark College.
This keynote address is addressing Dr. King and his legacy. I'll be talking about what we should be doing as community organizers and radical revolutionary movement people around what I call Trumpism and the idea of being ungovernable and not consenting to the predator-in-chief and his cabinet of abusers, because that's exactly what's about to be inaugurated in 3 days. And for many of us, we have to find really new ways of doing community work and grassroots organizing that really ensures that our communities can be safe in this age of Trumpism.
So there's a lot of aspects to that. One thing I've been thinking a lot about that kind of goes off of what you just said is, I unfortunately still listen to NPR some, and I listen to a lot of other stuff. And it seems like people, you know, with the exception of, you know, some people on KBOO and some people at a few other places, some Pacifica, there's still, the talk is still seems to be putting what's happening in like a normal framework. And of course, you know, things haven't completely changed. Obviously, you know, the communities that you come from have experienced the kind of stuff that maybe is in store more for the rest of us for quite a long time. But still, it is something seemingly qualitatively different to me anyway. You know, we really haven't experienced such a overt across the board authoritarian framework, which seems to be emerging similar really to the authoritarian capitalism that's emerged in many other places around the globe. But we still seem to be dealing within in sort of our old mental frameworks. Does that resonate with you?
I think what we're just seeing is outwardly what a lot of particularly right-wing people and politicians have been building a foundation for, you know, and Trump is literally the trumpets a lot of what particularly those elected officials have been wanting, but in the sense of the majority of Americans, and not just the communities where I come from, I grew up working class and I grew up middle class. So, I mean, I think there's also a fallacy that especially people of color come from like distressed communities all the time and crime-ridden communities all the time. Kind of when we see Trump attack John Lewis and say, your district is crime-ridden, not understanding that that's the part of Atlanta that's actually economically doing well, and that's a black middle-class kind of neighborhood. But with all that said, the majority of Americans, period, are suffering from inequality and are not having the resources that they need to live their daily lives, whether it's pay their rents or pay daycare or have health care or even have some money to save for retirement. So that across, you know, the economic inequality that has grown even in the last 2 years to levels that we have never seen, I think coupled with the increase of the temperature and climate change, is leading to even folks having to figure out what are the things that we are collectively fighting about for all of us. But in terms of how people of color were faring, we haven't been faring well even under a Black president. So, I would gather that the most marginalized people are probably the most prepared in a mental way for what Trumpism means. I think those that aren't prepared are particularly those that adhere to a liberal politic and haven't been paying attention to what a lot of communities, period, are going through, and have in one way have had their own set of privileges, whether you're liberal or left. A lot of those folks have privileges that have led them to intellectualize a lot of really what's going on a daily basis. So I think that's where we have to do a lot of the work right now and really build up what we call the grassroots. And that's from bottom up, from communities that are clear and have basically already been living in Trump's America.
But I hear all that. At the same time, you know, I certainly, I've only really, you know, obviously gotten this third or fourth hand, but, you know, my father grew up under Nazi occupation in northern Italy. And the sense I get, and, you know, these are too facile, too easy to make these comparisons, but the comparison I want to make is the way that I hate the word paradigm, like a whole different way of governing, of controlling the population. And again, as you said, there's many populations that have been controlled in this way. But there's something that's not rational about the phenomenon of authoritarianism, that like a new type of regime, a new type of, you know, I'm not saying there's going to be necessarily black shirts on the street, but, you know, we did see a taste of something like that in, you know, those Trump rallies. There's something quite frightening. People who talked about being at those rallies saw something really ugly. And if, you know, there is the possibility that that could become more generalized. And I think people are never prepared for that. And in fact, you know, from my very limited reading of history, one of the things that did allow, you know, these terrible authoritarian figures to arise was exactly the mental unpreparedness, the inability to actually recognize that something potentially new and different was emerging. Does that make sense?
I mean, it's all going to depend who you ask. I mean, we just had a political prisoner released yesterday, Oscar Lopez Rivera. I mean, he's been living under an authoritative, dictatorial type of government because of his political beliefs around Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican independence. So, I mean, you know, like, we have United States political prisoners that have been fighting this since the 60s that are still incarcerated to this day in the United States of America because they saw authoritative behavior from presidents in the 60s. So, you know, are people mentally prepared to America? Like, for the most part, I don't know if people are mentally prepared to do what it takes to really fight and have resistance and revolution. But I know that the most distressed communities are probably way more prepared than those of us who ascribe to liberal, progressive, or left. I mean, the idea that people are shocked that Trump won, it depends where you live. If you live in the East and the West Coast, if you live in, you know, vibrant cities, of course you thought Trump wasn't going to win. But if you live in the rest of America and you travel, I live in upstate New York, there were Trump signs 10-1. I never saw a Hillary Clinton sign. People would go, how could that be in New York State? Because you think New York City is the only environment in that entire state. And you forget that for, you know, 1,000 more miles, there's an entire state that does not think like New York City does. So, I mean, I think what's happening is that people who, you know, are not right-wing people, don't ascribe to conservatism, are still reeling over the fact that someone could, like Trump could win. Some of us know, of course, someone like a Trump could win. What the Republicans essentially did is give America a blockbuster, a really not a great film, but one that everybody's going to go see the minute it opens. The Democrats gave the worst PBS documentary we have ever watched.
That's a great analogy.
And if people, if people don't realize that that's where the majority of Americans are because of economic inequality, because of economic insecurity, then what ends up happening, what has been happening, again, in so-called progressive circles, however you want to ascribe an identity to your politics, is that we've also been talking to an echo chamber. We have, through an echo chamber, we have not been talking to the majority of people that it is very American to want somebody to, one person to save us. That's always been part of the American culture, that somebody's going to come and save and make everything better. Trump spoke to that. Was he manipulative? Is he a xenophobe, misogynist in every word? Yes. To other people that voted for him, half the people that voted, half voted for him, they're seeing the rest of us as like a bunch of intellectuals who have privilege. You can talk about authoritative behavior and history and all of that kind of stuff. But that's not changing the everyday live reality and conditions of folks, right? So, you know, I think people for a while are still going to be, even at the inauguration, are going to still be grappling with the fact that this is the president. A lot of us who are community organizers or activists know that as bombastic as he is, what we should be worrying about is who are going to run these departments and the vice president and other factors in his presidency that I don't even think a lot of people are prepared for because they're so focused on Trump and his insanity in Twitter. And I think that's part of the game that the particular Republican Party is playing on us.
Yeah, no, I definitely don't see it, you know, certainly not exclusively as Trump. I see it as a whole thing, you know, that Trump is just the tip of the iceberg, but he's the one who's sort of setting the tone for the time being. But yeah, no, I've been looking at those departments, and to me, it's, you know, it really does look like a, you know, I mean, calling it a coup obviously is putting it in the context of, you know, the original coup, which was, you know, the 1492 invasion, and then, you know, there's been many, many coups. You know, it's like, I think that's one, you know, unfortunately, that's what the problem of the terrible ahistorical nature of most of, you know, the people you're talking about. You know, I can count people in my own family for sure, and, you know, certainly people I've encountered. You know, there are many cultural divides. One of them is exactly a resentment. I think Nietzsche called it a resentment or something like that. This fundamental resentment against the people who maybe did have the benefit of having a quote education, did have the benefit of understanding and that's part of the resentment. That's part of what, you know, the Trump phenomenon, Trumpism, as you call it, is feeding on. And that,
yeah, but college students voted for Trump and educated white women with PhDs voted for Trump, and it's nowhere near what people we know a coup to be. Like, in the weirdest way, democracy worked. Now, in this way, that half the people who voted did vote for Trump. Did 3 million more popularly vote for Hillary Clinton? Yes, but nobody was worried about the Electoral College before. And this is what I'm talking about, especially for those that are progressive and left. If Hillary Clinton had won, no one would be in the streets. For the most part, who would be in the streets would be black and brown young people who've been fighting the last 6 or 7 years because literally they're being murdered by the police at record numbers. particularly black men and black women, right? So democracy worked and people don't like it. That's the thing. And a lot of us still, you know, not us who do this for a living, whether we're radio hosts or political commentators, but a lot of organizers are still, you know, going off that democracy didn't work. Well, actually, it did work, right? The popular vote didn't win, but we've been using the Electoral College. Maybe now we'll get rid of that. And so then it even goes to the thing, is this electoral-political two-party system one that we want to participate in? Well, half of the electorate still didn't vote, right? So out of 100% of an electorate, 49.2 did not vote in this election. So what is that saying? And who do we listen to? Do we continue to kind of listen to the punditry that comes out of our movement and, you know, that don't speak again to the lived reality of what's happening to most people on the streets and their experiences? Or do we now get to the point where we start to talk to those people who didn't vote and ask them, why didn't they vote? Maybe they know something more than we do. Maybe they have a different vision and future of what communities and organizing could look like outside of depending on the ballot. And we're not there right now because, again, this president hasn't been inaugurated. And, I mean, even the activities in D.C., as well-intentioned as they are, feed into, again, like, who is going to D.C. For who, for what purpose? It's always important to speak out. You know, and I think the hundreds of thousands of people going to D.C., for a lot of people, that'll be their first time. And it's important to always be part of a protest or to dissent or to have your voice. But the interesting thing is so many people going to D.C., black and brown folks that live in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area won't even be attending these events because there hasn't been full outreach to those folks, right? Like the ones that will be, especially in the what they call the DMV area, District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia, the most affected, which shows that we have work to do as organizers because this is still a huge disconnect. The Republicans and what they stand for and all the people they trickle down to, they don't have a disconnect. They have one thing that they can all come together around, that their candidate won, regardless of all the nastiness and all the isms and all the systemic things that went into play. We don't even have that within the other side right now. And I think for younger folks, they need to realize and really study the time that we're in as history is made every moment we live it. But then how are we coming together to find new ways of organizing that don't depend on old ways, particularly hierarchical structures or charismatic leaders or a reliance on the nonprofit industrial complex or the lack of more progressive media out there to counteract the noise coming from not just the mainstream, but even this new rise of alt-right independent media, because that's not connected to the mainstream, but they're rising in ways that even progressive media is not able to keep up with. So those are the things that we need to be discussing post his ascension to power on Friday. You know, those are the kind of conversations that people truly have to be having in order to have a new effective way of having a resistance that will counteract not just the public policy, but like you said, the authoritative behavior that's going to come down the pipeline and will affect marginalized communities the most, especially through militarized police.
So we're already halfway into the show, and I think I gave out the number early on, but I'm talking with Rosa Clemente, who is here in town in Vancouver to give a talk at the Geyser Student Center on Clark College's main campus at noon today, Wednesday. And if you want to join the conversation, the number is 503-231-8187. That's the number. We've got another half hour to go. And Rosa Clemente, as I mentioned at the outset, is currently a doctoral student in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of UMass Amherst. She's been a longtime community activist. We'll talk a little bit about your scholarship. What are some of the things you're studying?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? It went out.
Well, to talk about a little bit about, you know, you're being an activist scholar in these days. What are you focusing on right now?
Well, on my PhD, I'm doing my dissertation on Afro-Latino, Latinx identity in the United States and what we call the Black radical tradition. And, you know, a lot of my research is focused on those that are identified as Latino, Latina, Latinx, that racialize themselves as Black and particularly follow a Black radical politics set forth by folks like Marcus Garvey and Arturo Schomburg and what it means particularly for Latinx folks to identify and racialize themselves as Black. So that's the work I do, my research and dissertation. But as a scholar activist, which is definitely a term for those of us in the academy who use or who see the work that we're doing as academics as not disconnected from the community in any way. That's just some of the research I do and some of the work I do around, again, what we would call academic work or the academy.
I'd be interested. I interviewed a woman a few weeks ago about the idea of the new McCarthyism, and she was focusing on mostly in the university and a lot of the renewed heat that's coming down on people like yourself. I'd be interested to hear if you've been experiencing anything like that, if any of your colleagues, anyone you know about, work with, has been experiencing any specific repression, what the sort of environment has been like. But we do have a caller. Corey, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, thanks so much. How you doing, Miss Clemente?
Hey.
I'm a academic as well here in the Portland area, and I just want to say something and I want to get your response. I know myself as an academic, I am, you know, progressive in my thought, in my actions. But what I've seen over the past several months, a lot of Black and people of color, Latino clergy coming out on the forefront, Trump's putting a face on these people. And that's something I haven't really seen. I didn't see these people coming out even supporting the president. But I've seen a lot of people of color in the clergy, the Black church, even some of the Latino church coming out in support of Trump. And I think there's going to be a direct disconnect between Black intellectuals, progressives, versus the Black church coming up, because I find it hard to believe that many of these Black churches are supporting, and churches of color are supporting this man, and I'm trying to figure out why. Like, I've seen some of these pastors on television over the past couple weeks, and I find it sort of odd. I don't want to be conspiratorial, but it's like, what are you getting out of this? Who's paying you to come out here and sort of front for this man? So I just want to get your opinion on that. Do you think there is going to be some sort of, because I see the rift now, I just feel that the rift is going to get bigger, where we have a lot of Black intellectuals sort of having to come out for these progressive ideals, but I think that the Black clergy is going to be there more than anything to stop us. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you around visible church leaders. So, you know, I mean, simply put, I would think that they're getting either some form of money, compensation, a promise, the ability to be visibly known, to be on camera. And I mean, I really think, you know, from what I know from a lot of young folks on the ground, first, they don't see folks in the church in their generation as relevant at all. And secondly, they would call them what they are, which what we would say in when we talk to each other as folks of color. These are sellouts. These are folks that are literally selling out people, and the most marginalized have a pulpit, sometimes a bully one, and I think are in it for themselves, you know. And I don't think we have to even over intellectualize the fact that that is exactly what they're doing, and there is no accountability for their actions sometimes in our communities, so they're going to keep doing what they're doing. But I think they're being exposed a lot faster than before. And I think, again, younger people, especially those under 35, really have almost no connection to these type of leaders. So they'll do what they do, and we still have to organize the way we have to organize. I tell young, I tell my generation, older folks, not to spend a lot of time thinking about why they're doing what they're doing, because they're not spending any time thinking about the ramifications of what they're doing for the rest of us.
Well, I guess Corey's gone. We've got another call. Craig?
Yes, thank you. I have a little bit of a different take, although I'm very, very concerned about Mr. Trump and his cabinet and the direction he's taking. I think that another way to frame the issue is in regards to how we are categorically undermining future generations. Doesn't matter if you're black or brown or white or green or purple, we have totally undermined the future. And that is perpetuated even in institutions of higher education. That, as one friend of mine said, degrees in higher education are mostly about ritualized obedience, in which I added that one time led to privilege. But that privilege has been offshored and automated out of existence as we have rewarded the parasites and punished the common person. And that is true pretty much in all arenas of our lives. So why should we be surprised when the skills that we're teaching our young are indiscriminate violence? And then they come home and see no future and go ballistic. It is absolutely insane that we don't have enough common sense, including that which is coming out of institutions of higher education, to understand the wisdom of what Aristotle said 2,400 years ago when he said, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. Please comment.
I'm not sure if you were making more of a statement or what the question was, you know, to be honest. So, I think it's more of a philosophical difference, right? Because even when I hear it's not about color, well, of course it is, right? I mean, like, there's no way. I mean, the country is literally founded on the genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement of African people. And even in the best of times of the American project, African-American Latino people have never felt well collectively, right? So I would just gather that a lot of what you just said, or what I'm hearing definitely of what you said, is definitely a philosophical way of looking at things. So that would be what I would say.
You know, what I've been thinking a lot about is, as someone who's sort of mostly experienced my activism as a environmental, I guess, activist and Earth First and other things, I certainly got tuned into the devastation of the natural world, and I've been doing a lot of programming on climate change, and it does scare the bejesus out of one if one really looks at it. But, you know, I mean, it's certainly no solace in any way, shape, or form. But it, you know, in some ways, in a perverse way, I guess you'd say, we're, you know, the more privileged people, which I include myself for sure, are getting something of a taste of the lack of a future that so many generations. I mean, if you think back to the, you know, the time of enslavement and the time of the colony, the most brutal phase of colonization, I mean, those people didn't see much of a future for themselves. Their their children's future was ripped out from them. And as I say, it's no solace whatsoever to feel as if one can understand that a little more now when one is looking down the face of, you know, the Arctic. What's happening, the changes in the Arctic are, you know, are happening. It's no longer, you know, 50 years or 100 years down the line. We're talking, you know, potentially in the next 5 to 10 years, massive, massive transformations on planet Earth due to climate change. I don't think people really understand the massive die-offs that have been going on in the ocean recently is just one symptom. Anyway, that's my take on what our caller Craig had to say. So let me just say what's coming up here on KBOO. At 9 is the Project Censored show and a look at the too close relationship between the CIA and U.S. media. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And 11, the Food Show brings you hunger myths, meat addiction, and a Portland woman's vodka brand. And thank all of our members here at KBOO Community Radio for all of your support. And if you're not yet a current member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. So since we got a couple callers, I just want to throw this thing out here. I know I it's too easy for me as a talk show host to sort of be able to talk about stuff I've been involved in. But since you're a scholar, I just picked up this amazing book. I've been talking about some books and articles I've been reading recently on my show, but this is called Settlers, The Mythology of the White Proletariat from Mayflower to Modern by Jay Sakai. Are you familiar at all with this book?
I am not familiar with that book.
I would highly recommend it to all, to you and all our listeners. Anyway, it's a pretty amazing book, but I won't go into it since you are not yet familiar with it and we can't have a on-the-air chit-chat about it, but I think I will... I will read some of it in an upcoming show. Here, let me just read this. In fact, the 1960s breakthrough of ethnic studies programs at universities has been dialectically turned around and used against us. This is obviously a person of color speaking. We are getting imperialist-sponsored and imperialist-financed Asian studies, Black studies, Puerto Rican studies, Indian studies, ethnic studies pushed back down our throats. Some of the most prominent third-world intellectuals in the U.S. empire are getting paid good salaries by the imperialists to teach us our histories. Why? U.S. imperialism would rather that all third-world people in their empire remain totally blank and ignorant about themselves, their nations, their cultures, their pasts, about each other, but everything except going to work in the morning. But that day is over. So instead, they oppose enlightenment by giving into it in form, but not in essence. Like jujitsu, our original demand that our separate and unique histories be uncovered and recognized is now being used to throw us off our ideological balance. The imperialists promote watered down and distorted versions of our past as oppressed third world nations and peoples, and it goes on from there. What do you think about that?
I mean, I definitely would agree with aspects of that, especially the neoliberal turn that higher education has taken. But not all ethnic studies departments are like that, and not all, you know, in every academic space, there are radicals and resistors, right? And our job in those spaces, if we choose to be in them, is to try to turn our young folks into scholar activists that have intellectual capacity to find innovative solutions for their communities and to be organizers, right? So, you know, and I would gather that many people in Black studies, women's studies, in all the studies that we've had to fight to integrate into the academy and the curriculum, many of us are aware of the occupation and imperialistic nature of higher education, right? Even with that, it is a space, especially out of Black studies. And I know that most Black studies departments still have an undergirding of decolonization and deconstruction that many, many young people benefit
from having those type of scholar activists on a campus. I can attest to that as someone who came up that way and someone now who brings up young folks in that way, along with a lot of my colleagues in different spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our next caller. Camila, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been struggling with a question, trying to figure out how to frame it, but I'll just put it out there as best I can. And I recognize the point that colonialism, slavery, genocide of the indigenous around the globe has left us with a legacy of this intense identity consciousness. And I recognize the importance of needing to understand it in its truth and in its complexity. But I struggle with the fact that this continues to leave us in division and conflict. And on the left, we see we're...
Is that what leaves us in division and conflict, or is it something else?
Well, I think that's a manifestation of it. Certainly the underlying factors that contribute to it. But the point that I want to get is that I think that we need to figure out how to achieve solidarity. How do we embrace universalist values in this context?
Okay, well, let's hear.
Yeah, I mean, that we won't be embracing until racial justice is at the forefront of law movements. I think it's difficult when there's such a divide even in how we talk about issues of race and racial justice. But people have to see, particularly living in the United States, that we live under a systemic systems of white supremacy, right? And a lot of times when people start talking about, well, maybe we shouldn't talk about identity as much, or that's what's dividing us. Usually, you know, those folks, many of them, sometimes many white, literally do not understand and can't. And that's not by anybody's fault. You're born how you are, right? And then race is a construction, and it is a construction, but it's a lived reality and experience for many of us that are African American, Latino, Black and Brown, people of color, whatever these terms that we use as terms of solidarity. So I think we have to double down on racial justice now more than ever before. When you're dealing with issues of racial justice, our intersectionalities have always been there, right? But even if we look at the conversation happening in some liberal circles, even coming out of Bernie Sanders' mouth where he says, we need to focus on the white working class. Really? That's what you need to focus on? First of all, the majority of working class people are Black and Brown people. So right there, that kind of stuff assumes that we as Black and Brown folks don't have the intersectionality understanding around capitalism, imperialism, homophobia, transphobia, all these things that are part and parcel of our identities too. But when a country is founded on the genocide of indigenous people, the exploitation of migrants, beginning with Asian people, and then the actual enslavement and the ongoing police murders of our people, when people don't want to center that, that becomes one of the main problems in organizing. You know, so for us as folks of color, so the idea that we would never bring who we are, our 100% self, which includes who we are as a racial group of people, as an ethnic group of people, is very dangerous. And, you know, people have to really understand. Like, even if we understand the Trump campaign, Trump didn't start his campaign with free trade agreements are bad, Wall Street is bad, and Obamacare is bad. No. He started it with building the wall, deporting, quote-unquote, illegal people in a Muslim registry. That's how he started his campaign.
So for folks to ask us, especially those of us who have these identities, to maybe make that secondary or third, are not even understanding how Trump started his campaign and eventually won his campaign. And lastly, we have something where we say in the movement, when black and brown people in this world are free, we will all be free, because then that's when we're talking about the issue of humanity and what the caller said around universalist ideas, which is the utopic ideal, right? Like, we want to get there. We don't always want to be dealing with issues of racial injustice, but when you're black and brown in America, every issue is intersected and is an issue of racial injustice for the most part. So, you know, it's just, I don't think it's much a disagreement as this is how we live our lives, and folks that don't have the same body or same experience want to sometimes always go to the highest ideal, when where some of us are just trying to walk and not be confronted by the police, or not be thought that we're going to be deported, or not be thought that we were going to be a criminal, or all these kind of things that happen regardless of the position that I, as a black Puerto Rican person, occupies in any situation. Is often what we have to realize is the conditions that keep us, or the conditions that we actually live in, not always the position that we're in.
So I assume you're probably in touch with what's going on in Puerto Rican activism. Maybe that's an unwarranted assumption, but you seem like a person who probably is. Do you have anything to say about what's going on there? I mean, we get these all, you know, in general, what the general we here is, especially, you know, so far away on the West Coast, I guess, is, you know, the financial crises, the, you know, stuff like that. Anything to tell us about what's going on the ground?
I mean, in Puerto Rico is under a huge financial economic crisis because we remain a colony of the United States, and we've been abused by United States corporations and the government to the point of a deep, deep, deep economic crisis, which is seeking to really privatize all the commons in Puerto Rico. And now that the Promesa bill has passed, which President Obama signed, is that basically kicked in a lot of austerity measures on the island, all the way to the minimum wage going down to $4.25 starting next year for those workers that are under 27.
Oh my
and
God.
Privatizing now, potential privatizing of the university system. So the crisis has been coming, and it hit its head. It really hit a point last year where the United States government had to step in, as it does when a colony is under crisis. With that, there's a lot of young folks that have left schooling to be part of protests and continuing camps, what they call encampamentos throughout Puerto Rico, and really on the streets, and beginning to also organize cooperative communities and cooperative economics, and figuring out how local communities are going to come together the wave of this economic crisis, which is going to get worse.
I'm
with
interested
that
in
said,
what you said.
Yesterday,
okay.
President Obama gave clemency to Oscar Lopez Rivera, the last United States Puerto Rican political prisoner, or Puerto Rican political prisoner in the United States jail. And that comes after a 30-plus-year struggle of organizations and millions of people throughout the world fighting for Oscar to come home. And yesterday, that is a victory that we achieved. I think with that victory, with Oscar literally being able to come back to Puerto Rico in 3 or 4 months, and young people seeing that collective struggle works, but that it can take a while, you know, that everything we fight for is not immediate. And
particularly Oscar Lopez Rivera represents that, not only for Puerto Ricans, for all of us who are doing the work. I mean, Oscar was in jail, almost 40 years. And from the day he was in jail until yesterday when President Obama signed that piece of paper to give him clemency, there's been a struggle to free him. And I think it's very important that people take these lessons right now, that this collective struggle may take a while to achieve results. I will say, this has nothing to do with Puerto Rico in particular, that the crisis of climate change, is, as you mentioned before, is something that people need to understand. Young people of color are very clear about climate change and the crisis that we're in, and that they are doing work that, again, has the intersection of climate change as becoming a primary thing that we organize around. Because we're seeing, especially those of us who do come from island nations in the Caribbean, the devastation already of climate change, right? And this idea that there are already climate refugees and there will be millions more. And I think it's really important for folks like me who, you know, have we're public people, especially if we're African American or Latino, that no conversation we have, no organizing thing that we do cannot talk about the climate crisis that we're in right now. And I see a lot of young folks really on the ground that have brought this to the forefront. It might have not been an issue for people 5 or 10 years ago, but there's literally no denying what we're going through. And I would agree with you that that is the immediate crisis that has to be slowed down, because that's all we could potentially do right now is slow down. Or this is the crisis that really does unite everybody from every kind of demographic to come together to build a national movement, especially with the people who are about to take office now. I think that's important to recognize and to state. It's critical.
Yeah, if we're looking for something universal, forces
right
of nature.
I mean, today the Times just came out that they said even the science that they thought was right about the temperature going up actually was wrong, and it's worse, you know, than anyone could imagine. And I was actually at a retreat a couple of weeks ago, and Naomi Klein, when she was talking, you know, was so passionate about it. And obviously Naomi is one of our greatest modern folks around this, but her passion and also what she was telling us, you know, even made people in that room who have had good intersectionality around all these issues, like, take notice and be like, oh my God, you know, it's worse than I even thought. So if that's the case, and I consider myself an activist, a public intellectual, like all these community organizers, grassroots, where am I failing in my work? And I think people can take that as just a lesson of the work that we should be moving towards and doing, and how we envision a new way of doing local and national organizing work that always is going to address this as a primary center issue as well.
Well, we're just about out of time. I apologize to Sunny. We're not going to be able to get you on this week. We're pretty much at the time to close out. I just want to repeat a couple things. Someone didn't know about this book that I mentioned, Settlers, The Mythology of the White Proletariat from Mayflower to Modern by Jay Sakai, S-A-K-A-I. It's out on PM Press just a couple years ago, I believe. And also my guest, Rosa Clemente, will be speaking at noon today, in just a few hours, at Clark College. And that's at the Geyser, G-A-I-S-E-R, Student Center on Clark's main campus, noon to 1:30, so they can meet you there.
Yeah, I'll be there. I hope to see people out, and I really appreciate you having me on the show. And folks could also check out my work at rosaclemente.net. And for all those going to
the inauguration as part of disruption and resistance. I'm there in spirit. I'll be in Albany, New York, doing local community marches and teaching and things like that. But, you know, I think it's always important to disrupt and to resist and to be an oppositional voice. And we need that now in ways that we never thought we would need and ways we haven't imagined, you know, and we just need to be out there as part of the resistance.
All right. So get involved locally. Thank you so much, Rosa.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. And she'll be again this afternoon, noon at Clark College. And this is the end of our time. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for our Youth of Color Production Internship Program. This internship is open to people of color attending college and or under the age of 30. This is a 6-month internship for 20 hours a week for $20 an hour. Responsibilities include the selection and preparation of KBOO content for national distribution using a variety of digital audio workstations and helping to develop a digital content strategy for promotion of KBOO content. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 27th at 5 p.m. More information, including skills and qualifications, can be found at kboo.fm/productionintern2017.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. This event was originally scheduled for Friday, January 13th. Giving Back illustrates Black philanthropic experiences and giving traditions grounded in faith, mutuality, responsibility, and social justice. Images and stories are from the book Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African American philanthropists. Again, that's the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th, at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on